Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, December 1st. We have today Sven Lorenz and Ira Harris. Sven's website, undervalue-shares.com, identifies unique opportunities from around the world from a value investing perspective. Alongside being an active writer, he also serves as CEO of Sarnia Asset Management, a newly launched fund manager based in Guernsey, the Channel Islands. He has 25 years plus experience in startups, turnarounds, and fund management. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint most recently. He maintains a blog at iragharris.com. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here.
Nice to be here.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Sven, with your mandate for Undervalued Shares, why you started the new venture, and you know why the approach you take makes sense, especially now given the macro trends in the economy and the financial markets.
So my website is very much an idea generation website. That's how I would like to see it. My readers appreciate that I look at companies and at sectors and at parts of the world that most other people don't right now are very much paying attention to. And it also has a bit of an educational background and some entertainment angle to it as well, because I travel quite extensively and I send notes to my readers from around the world with my observations, which usually tie in with global events, but also take them a bit along on the journeys that I'm on and just try to provide my readers with a little bit of a different perspective and some fresh ideas.
That is so interesting. Could you describe your process for finding and identifying? Do you focus on like specific jurisdictions, types of assets, industries, and sectors?
So I always have to, I smile when I hear anyone speak about the investment process, because if you've been in this industry for a while, as both of you have been, you know that everyone describes the same process where you've got like 100,000 shares worldwide, and then you've got a funnel, and into that funnel goes a certain number of shares that come out through a filter. And of course, that's the technical way of describing what fund managers do. But I think there's very much a human element to it as well. And ultimately, what my readers are looking for are ideas that they couldn't find anywhere else. And if you just apply a couple of filters to a Bloomberg terminal, then you know you just get the same results. You get the same companies that everyone else is looking at. And we've just lived through a period in financial market history where you could just look at most of the large mutual funds. They all had the same stocks in their portfolio. And that worked some of the time, but it's just been very much to their detriment recently. And with my website and my blog and my research, what people get is very much my personal observations and my personal experience, 30 years plus of having almost built up a database in my brain of interesting companies and special situations. And I may be a little bit random in the ideas that I come up with. I can't describe, you know, like a very technically perfect system for that. But I think this is really what makes it so interesting. It's down to human instinct, to personal experience, and to spotting things that other people haven't spotted yet. And that's why you need to have your own brain first and foremost as tool to work with rather than Bloomberg filters.
Yes, exactly. And in terms of the environment, what are your thoughts on this secular change that we see actually happening between tech value and investing? So basically like from the tech high growth equities into value-based equities, do you see that as a long-term secular change? What are your thoughts behind that?
Oh, it's huge. And I think we'll only realize in a couple of years just how big the change has been that we have been probably just seeing the first inning of. So I'm a value guy, and I'm somewhat of a fan of tech. I've been invested in some tech companies. But I've been saying for years that valuations had just been excessive. And I mean, we, between us, we know that most of these companies have had issues with actually earning money for their shareholders rather than to just spend it all and be almost like, you know, providing a public good. I always thought that when I took an Uber cab, the shareholders of Uber were subsidizing my personal life. And that was just completely unsustainable. And it's really just one example with what has happened to interest rates now. And I think also with certain changes in the zeitgeist, in sort of the spirit of the ages, we're definitely moving back to an age of value again and of, let's call them, more conservative valuation metrics. And I think we're just in the first phase of that. And that's going to unfold at least for 3 to 5 years, possibly throughout the rest of the 2020s. We're in a different world now, all of a sudden. And it's very much to our advantage because value is going to be back on vogue. And with value, what I really mean is real earnings, companies that have genuine competitive advantages that are truly sustainable, not in the environmental sense, that's just one aspect, but that can just generate shareholder returns for years and decades to come rather than, you know, produce a bit of a hyped story and then after 2 years just collapse under their own weight.
Yes, that's a very interesting perspective. Your thoughts, Ira, do you see the same secular change on this environment?
Well, I'm forever seeing change. It's what this business is about. And I've lectured at enough university classes as a guest lecturer, I'm not a full-time, but people did bring me in. And I always explain to people, I said, if you work off of static models and believe in those static models without changing, there's no way that you can operate, especially in the global macro world. It's too dynamic. And you always have to look at that dynamicism, whatever promotes it. We could just go back to yesterday. You know, everybody was set, well, this is, and they find, and I think Sven's comments are 100% right, because we see it. And we started down this path Tuesday before we got kind of sidelined. Because some of that tech stuff wasn't working out too well. Sorry, Richard. I think it had more to do with Canada. I'll blame it on Trudeau. But you see the way that things really change. And yesterday was a class. It's not about a pivot. Powell delivered exactly. He talked about a pause. A pause is not a pivot. So if I went to 8% tomorrow and I said, I'm stopping here, which I believe the Fed should have done this much earlier, gotten to a level and said, we're stopping and we're going to, you know, in the way that I see the world, we're going to move faster on quantitative tightening. Why? Because quantitative easing provided exactly what Fed is talking about. You had loose money, and loose money raised people's sense of urgency about certain companies that had no business and you could borrow for free. So I don't call them zombies. It's just, you know, zero interest rates, 1%, 2% is not a real reflection of what capitalism is about. It's a period in time in which people, so then you go start searching. There is no such thing as valuation for most people. So they chase these, what, unicorns. It's not my word, it's their word. And with them are rainbows. But now that money is, again, sustaining some type of modicum of money as value for the first time, now we're seeing that these other valuations have been baloney all the time. So I'm with Fenn. I'm looking for firms.
And if I can just add one observation that I've had for decades, and I've never mentioned it anyway, I'm just dying to get it out there finally on a podcast. Yeah. And Ira and Richard, I don't know if you've noticed the same, and maybe that's just a sign of my age, but in the last 10 years, I noticed that on the investor relations websites of public corporations, it became harder and harder to find the number of outstanding shares. And of course, the number of outstanding shares is what ultimately determines the market cap and the valuation of the company. And I just took that as a clear sign that, I mean, so many people I speak to who actually do invest money don't really even have an understanding anymore of what a market capitalization is. What is the value of a company? And instead, you saw lots of, you know, corporate gobbledygook on the website and stuff about, I don't know, their values and God knows what else. But you couldn't figure out what the entire company is worth because you had to like spend 10 minutes on the website looking for that one bit of information right. That should be like immediately out there. And I think that that really summarized the madness of the age we've just lived through. Valuations didn't matter anymore. And, you know, finally, the world's woken up again. And we all know what that was caused by.
Totally agree. And actually,
So, you know, I always go back to, and he's British, Bernard Connolly. I don't know if you know of Bernard Connolly, who wrote The Rotten Heart of Europe. Brilliant economist. Bernard and I have become friends because of that book. It started, I mean, I could tell you this, one day I stood out on 40th and Fifth Avenue at a Starbucks. We stood having a coffee for 3 hours as Bernard and I talked about exactly this. And this was right at the beginning, probably 2011, 2012. And he was railing really against QE and how it was just that wonderful phrase, intertemporal dislocation. We keep bringing demand forward and everybody is pricing equity valuations and all this demand brought forward, not thinking about what the world's going to hold for him. And once you get to you get to what I consider a very important fundamental, which is real interest rates on the short term, especially. What's the real yield? Don't give me the nominal yield, because I think nominal yields will drive equity prices higher because people will look at me and go, well, I can't put my money in the bank when inflation is 8% and they're paying me 3%. I'm still losing money. So I have to go searching for things that on any other day you say, I'm not buying that. That's crazy. But people buy, they will buy crazy. So yeah, thank you. That was great. I'm glad you got that out there.
Yeah. And just to add to that, back on your comment, Sven, for the outstanding shares, it is difficult to find. And what we like to do in our firm is look at total shares outstanding history, like going back the last 3 years or the last 5 years to see that that change or that trend, if it's stable or if they're diluting shares by printing shares, you know, using the same method as the central banks today. Printing money. But the other thing is, if it is going down, looking at how the shares are going down, the outstanding shares, is it through share buybacks using debt or share buybacks using cash, right, or liquidity? So that's an important point, in addition to looking at positive free cash flow and little or manageable debt. Those are big factors we look at. And so Sven, I wanted to ask, the opportunities that you identify, are they all public exchange traded equities? Like, do they have an ISIN number, or what is the asset universe for your
perspective? Absolutely. I'm an equities guy, and I really only look at publicly listed equities, very much on a global basis. But I think what has happened in the last 10 years, and that's especially noteworthy for probably your very US-centric audience, is that it's become a lot easier to trade shares in major markets around the world. And for example, I mean, Interactive Brokers, who've got like, I think, 2 million customers, they can trade in 44 different markets. And that's a NASDAQ listed company. So, you know, that didn't exist 10 years ago, and that's become a lot easier. So anyone who wants to, even with relatively small amounts of money, can trade on a global basis. So they've got access everywhere, but it needs to be listed somewhere. I'm not doing all this private stuff because that's just not my universe. Mm-hmm.
Cool. And let's delve into some examples. So one example you'd like to cover is Crisud. It's an agricultural and urban real estate firm based in Argentina, but it covers all of a lot of countries in Latin America. Can you elaborate?
Yes. So what I'm always trying to show to my readers is that there are different ways to get exposures to themes that we all care about or that we're all exposed to. And obviously right now, food prices and potential food scarcity is a subject that's very much in public discussion. And that's why I suggested that it's worth taking another look at a company called Crisud, which is Argentinian, but it's trading on the New York Stock Exchange. And of course, the first point that everyone will raise is that Argentina is going through never-ending boom and bust cycles, to which I say, yes, exactly. And that's why we're interested in it. If you go back at and look at the history of the share price of Crisud, basically over the past 20 years, that company has also been undergoing a never-ending boom and bust cycle. And you can utilize that to your advantage. The company owns about 700,000 acres of farmland in Argentina. And if you look up history books, about 100 years ago, Argentina was actually richer on a per capita base than the United States because it has such fertile farmland. And the entire country pretty much lives off its agricultural exports. That's pretty much what Argentina has to make do with nowadays. So that's a national priority. And the stock had, when I first introduced it a year and a half ago, it was trading at a low again. And besides the farmland, they also own a portfolio of prime property in Buenos Aires. And in terms of valuation, and this is really the most interesting bit, the stock was so low that you were essentially paying them only for their biggest farm, for the core farm operation. All the other farmland and all the other real estate in Buenos Aires was thrown in for free. And governance standards nowadays around the world are actually much, much better than one commonly perceives. So that's not really the biggest issue. The issue with that stock is a timing issue. But in conclusion, it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, so it's very easy to trade. It's very easy to get information about it in the English language. And it's just a different way to play that entire theme of food prices and food scarcity.
What's the symbol, if I may ask?
Cresy.
C-R-E-S-Y.
C-R-E-S-Y. Yeah. So I'm glad we're going to, because I don't usually discuss equity so much, but from a global macro perspective, that's a perfect fit for me, because that's, I can look at a top down and I love food, but, and I think Latin America is 100% right. But see, I use Bunge, because Bunge is in, through a very source I know, Claff Realty out of Chicago, have bought farmland down in Uruguay for the same reason. But the Uruguay takes the currency out because they're on the dollar standard. And I just applaud the way that you thought that through. And right, nobody wants any part of Argentina. We all know about all the bad politics, the autocratic. I actually do know quite a bit because I studied Latin American politics and economics for a long time. So, wow, that's just a great fit. And it is so underappreciated. So underappreciated.
Yeah. So, and I mean, speaking of bad politics, I think we, as you know, living in North America and Europe, Western Europe, it's getting increasingly difficult to point the finger at these countries.
That's a fact. You know what, we forget about that too. But here I'm looking at YPF, the energy company that's out of Argentina. I mean, these are all companies that everybody turns away from. And if, and especially, I don't know how you feel about this, right? But if they're not in an ETF, you're even going to get them at a better valuation, because a lot of times companies get bid up because the arbitragers or those who trade those ETF have to buy the underlyings. So even lousy companies get bid away. So when a company is outside an ETF, I find that a lot of times when the market is depressed, their valuations are really attractive because nobody's even paying attention to them. They don't fit a preconceived model, and there's no need to purchase it. So I really applaud that. That's great.
Excellent. And the second example is also from Argentina, Pampa Energia.
Yes, and I thought I'd introduce that to your followers, because it just so neatly fits into something that we read about the newspaper every single day, and where I think a lot of people, especially from our walk of life, value investors, have very strong feelings. So obviously energy prices have gone up massively, and there are now issues with energy supply, and where is it actually coming from, and how safe is it, and how safe are our long-term supply of it. And Pampa Energia is such an interesting one, because it benefits very directly from some political decisions that have been made in the United States. And I think, as probably everyone is aware, when the Biden administration got into office, they very much turned against the domestic energy industry in the United States, and especially fracking. And Argentina basically said, well, thank you very much. That's great, because we've got all this gas and potential fracking energy down here, this potential for developing fracking-based energy resources. And what is ultimately happening is now that expertise in the form of highly trained people and equipment and capital from the United States that used to go into the domestic fracking sector is now emigrating more or less to Argentina, where they're very welcome and where there are golden opportunities in developing this. And again, this is a sector that has strategic importance for Argentina. And the best of all is that everyone always thinks that in Argentina, you are necessarily exposed to their currency problems. Obviously, the Argentinian peso is one of the highest inflation rate currencies in the world. But most of the business that Pampa Energía does is actually done in US dollars, and including sales of energy in Argentina, where the Argentinian government guarantees payments in US dollars. So this is an oddball of a company where you're basically paying an Argentinian valuation, but most of the business is in United States dollars. And on a business development level, it's just benefiting from what I would describe as not very wise political decisions elsewhere. So, you know, send your money where it's treated best. And that is a good example why you should do that. And that stock is also traded on the New York Stock Exchange with a ticker symbol PAM.
Interesting. And did you have any thoughts, Ira, on that one? Or
no, and one thing that we've learned, it's not only gold. I'll tell you this right now, Sven. I don't believe precious metals are really an inflation hedge. Because when inflation sets in, it's already too late. I always believe that the precious metals, and I've been on this for two, three decades already, are a vote or a not, or for or against central bank credibility. And when you have Argentina, and we learned this in Zimbabwe, right? When Zimbabwe inflation screamed and other places had high inflation, people buy real assets. And equities are real assets. If the company, if you know the company is, you know, as we can kick its tires and see what it's doing, and especially if it's earning, as you rightly point out, in a foreign currency, which is the ultimate great hedge, right? You're getting paid in US dollars and you're in Argentina. Well, it's the same with the Brazilians. When the real went from 1.8 all the way up to what, 6, Brazilian agriculture was killing it because they were growing substantially and Brazilian farmers were earning in dollars and changing it into reals. And once inflation settled down, they made boatloads of money. I mean, it's not a mistake why Brazil is now the largest soybean producer in the world.
Interesting. And the third example is GPW in Poland.
Oh, yes, that's one of my favorite stories, although I have to admit I'm currently on the wrong side of the market on that one. So I think everyone has come across the publicly listed stock exchanges. So somewhat counterintuitively, a stock exchange is a business as well, and it can also be traded as a stock. And some of them have just been among the best investments in the world in the last 10 or 20 years because increasing trading volumes. Oh yeah, of course, and IRA has the shirt to match.
I'm wearing a CME sweatshirt just by to keep warm.
Yeah, no coincidence there. And they are, of course, highly scalable businesses because most of the trading is done electronically. And if trading volumes increase, that just dramatically increases the profitability of these platforms. So if you had shares in the London Stock Exchange or the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, or I guess the international, what is it called? The ticker symbol is ICE in the United States.
Intercontinental Exchange.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, these have all been phenomenal investments, and most of them are traded at very high multiples and deservedly so, one has to say. And One of them that got away so far is the Polish Stock Exchange. So the Warsaw Stock Exchange is listed in Warsaw as well. And it has a monopoly in Poland. And Poland has been developing much better in economic terms in the last 20 years than most people are aware of. It was actually reclassed as a developed market recently. It's not an emerging market anymore. And Poland has had some of the most consistent and highest growth rates in the world in the last 20 years. And its stock market has always been among the cheapest, but a lot of change has taken place there as well. The stock market in Poland was always known for lots of old economy companies, but the high tech and especially the gaming sector in Poland has been very successful of late. They have a lot of healthcare going on. They have a highly educated workforce in Poland. So the economy is really on the up and is being transformed. And I placed a bet that the Polish Stock Exchange as a business would benefit mightily from that as well. And when I first wrote about it, it was the cheapest publicly listed stock exchange in the world and came with a 5% dividend yield and a few other, you know, attractive trades. The stock has not done as well yet as I had hoped it was going to do. And that's got in no small measure, that's got to do with the conflict in Ukraine, which is obviously right next door. And that's been depressing the Polish stock market in general. So it's down about a third since I've written about it. It's still super cheap. The story is still very much there. And the reason why I like it and why I like introducing it to your followers is because it's an example how you can take a learning from your domestic market, from your home market, and take it abroad. So in the United States or in Western Europe, you're not going to find a single stock in that particular business sector anymore that's cheap, but you have to look a bit further afield, and then you find something that is probably 10 or 20 years behind, but will do just as well as Western exchanges have done in the last 10 or 20 years. So, you know, find something that has worked elsewhere, but that's just in a different part of the cycle, and then apply your learnings from elsewhere. And I think that works quite well much of the time.
So if I can ask a question, do you see like those types of exchanges being consolidated, especially if one day they find a way to create a euro bond? You know, everything's going on in Europe. There's no euro bond.
Yeah. Absolutely. Ira, you're spot on. Consolidation is really the name of the game here. The world only really needs a handful of large exchanges. Right. And these national exchanges make little sense. And in Poland, I think that will be recognized sooner or later as well. If they want to be competitive, they have to become part of something bigger. And then eventually this company is probably going to get sold. I mean, with exchanges, there's always a slight emotional element to it. And some countries see it as a strategic asset, which frankly, I think that's a bit of a 1980s view of the whole matter. But these views take a long time sometimes to get worked out of the system. But yeah, eventually that company will either merge or be taken over by someone else. And that's part of the attraction. In the meantime, you get a 5% dividend yield. You have no downside because of a low valuation. The business is growing. It's highly scalable. And there's no real risk because it's a monopoly on top of it.
So, Richard, can I ask, as long as we're delving into European finance, and I've been off the European banks for a long time, just because, you know, I have a certain view. I'm steeped in the learning from Bernard Connolly and understanding the rotten heart of Europe, so to speak. But now I'm kind of making my way back there, almost from the same reasons that you see. So it's like, you know, I talk about this with people. I watch Commerzbank in Germany, which has been, let's just call what it is, an absolutely piece of crap for all the right reasons. It's done nothing. It's been the story of consolidation with Deutsche Bank for so many years. But I believe that if Europe is going to survive, they're going to have to create a Eurobond. And the European Central Bank has actually talked about this and how it would be done. And if they did it, they would go to a broker-dealer type system. There is no broker-dealer type system for sovereign debt in Europe at this point. And they also made an interesting point that you would have to be domiciled there, meaning they didn't want Goldman, they didn't want Morgan Stanley, they didn't want the big U.S. banks to do this from the U.S. You had to have a presence within the EU. So I said, interesting. Comer sits out there. It violates every one of my rules because I'm like you. If I'm in the financial world, I'm buying things with dividends because they're evidently throwing off enough cash and not necessarily share buyback. I like the dividends. Throw me the cash. Let me make the decisions. I don't need you trying to pick a right valuation for your company. That's my job, not your job. And it's the other investor's job. But I watch. So as long as we're talking, I'm watching this Comerce. I don't know whether you have a feeling about it, but I throw it out there.
Yeah, no, Ira, I think you're 100% on the right path here. So as you alluded to, European banks have not been anything that anyone would want to look at for longer than we can think back, certainly at least a decade. And that's been changing in the last 3 months. So suddenly people are starting to look at names that we haven't considered as a potential investment for many years. Commerce Bank is one example. I have to admit, I haven't got any specific knowledge of Commerce Bank, but there are so many banks in Europe that have basically just spent well over a decade fixing their balance sheet and completely restructuring their business. And suddenly they have an interest rate margin again. They're actually making money. And they operate generally in markets that have been fully consolidated. You have a handful of players and they are highly profitable. And there's no real risk of earnings going down more than, say, 25-30% during a recession. And the stocks are trading at multiples of 4 or 5 times earnings and with a, you know, 5 to sometimes 10% dividend yield. And this is something, this is a theme that's currently emerging as no one thought it would ever come back, but here we are, it is coming back.
Yeah, and the value, and if you look at, you know, I love Chris Whalen and he always, as he stressed, he doesn't talk about the European banks, but you're always looking at, you know, especially when it comes to banks, book value. And I'll bet that Comerce is now probably about 0.2, 0.3%, not 3%. I mean, so it's the value, it's not paying a dividend, but as you rightly say, they are making money now. They've gone from the negative deposit rate at the ECB. And if we're listening to the ECB right, and I think this is going to take place at the December meeting, because Lagarde cannot allow quantitative tightening. So rates will go a little bit higher. So we're at 2%. Why not go to 3%? You know, if I was them, I'd go to 3% at the next meeting. They won't because there's a battle. But I think we'll see 75 basis points because inflation. I mean, they were celebrating 10% German inflation yesterday. I was laughing. I said, it's still 10%. You're celebrating? It's. But thank you. I really, you got a great perspective. So I want to throw that out there for anybody who.
Yes, and also a great perspective, Sven, on what can be done with some problem situations. You have great experience. So if we can look at Russia, you know, that's been a lot of investment there until recently, some good companies there, Gazprom, Norilsk, but some of the listings have either been frozen in limbo or delisted in the Western exchanges. Is there anything that can be done on those shares or Russian ETFs for like collecting dividends?
Yes, there's certainly a lot that can be done. It is admittedly quite a complicated subject, not because the subject matter as such is so complicated, but because it's so chaotically managed. And Reuters recently published a very good article that just summarized that basically the same bank or the same broker might give different clients completely different answers. And unfortunately, it's become almost impossible to give anyone specific advice on this because the way how brokerage companies and banks are handling this matter is chaotic and quite random almost. In theory, it shouldn't be all that difficult to resolve it. And I know quite a few banks and brokers that have resolved this issue for their clients. There are basically two ways how to deal with it. If you have one of these Russian ADRs or GDRs, then your broker or your bank should be able to convert it into the ordinary share, which you then won't be able to sell because it's only listed on the Moscow Stock Exchange and you currently can't access that. But at least then you don't have an ADR or GDR anymore and you have the actual underlying share. And the other alternative is that you open a so-called C account with a bank or brokerage firm in Russia that is a limited brokerage account specifically for foreigners and specifically also for foreigners who cannot visit. And there are different procedures how you can transfer your ADRs and GDRs into that account and have it converted into ordinary shares. And there was even a procedure now until a few days ago to do that, even if your current Western broker and bank doesn't consent to it and doesn't cooperate. This involves a lot of paperwork. You need some specialized advice for that. There are some law firms that handle that. You could also do it all by yourself using the internet as a resource. This so-called forced conversion that I just described, where your bank and broker doesn't need to collaborate, that is probably going to be opened again early next year. So this is a subject we could do a different podcast about and make it 10 hours and still not cover every angle and aspect of it. The long and short of it is that a lot can be done. Sadly, a lot of banks and brokerage firms are just leaving their clients hanging and are not really paying the kind of care and attention to it that it deserves. I also think that in just to add one sentence, I think that by next spring, everyone will have become so tired of the subject that some conclusion, some solution will emerge, which could also be, you know, being bought out of these stocks at a discount or something like that. So don't give up just yet. It's going to be resolved one way or another, I think. These assets don't just disappear.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
I'm listening because I own RSX, which is the only ETF I ever buy, plain and simple. And I've been in there and they have a valuation for it. But, you know, I've sat back and said, you know, the U.S. policy is kind of stupid because you should have allowed the Russians are selling their oil. I only have to look at the ruble to know what's going on and the flows are. And you would have actually drained them of some money if you would have said, well, keep paying those dividends out, because that's just money that's sitting in Russia. If you paid out all the shareholders, they had already been in the stock. You can't get out. Why wouldn't you necessitate a payment? Yeah, if you ever want to be listed again in Western capital markets, you have to pay these dividends. You owe that. That's part of the legal, and you would have drained capital. They don't think these things through. You know, they say sanctions, sanctions, sanctions. And I argued vehemently when, Dalip Singh was on 60 Minutes talking about the greatness of the sanctions. And I sat there and watched it. I go, that's way too arrogant and really not thought out. And it can't, Russia's too important.
And I mean, speak of shooting an own goal. What the West has really done is badly damage the trust in property rights and in financial market mechanisms, because the bag holders here are just people who invested believing they would get a decent return from a company. Yeah. There are American pension funds and other just completely, you know, run-of-the-mill financial institutions who are invested in these kinds of papers and securities. And we just can't have faith anymore now that these rights of security owners are respected. And that's a huge own goal for the Western financial industry.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Interesting. What do you think of Brazil with the recent election, Lula winning and taking over, I think next month in the new year here? Are there risks in Brazil? What are your thoughts on Petrobras as well, the oil company there?
So, I mean, the long and short of it is it's not good, because Lula is a left-wing politician, agitator, whatever you want to call him. And it's already become apparent over the last couple of days that Petrobras, the national oil company that is also listed on the stock market, will be messed with. And Petrobras is not the same Petrobras that it used to be 10 years ago. There are safety mechanisms in place. There are totally different governance standards. So Lula cannot just completely, you know, take down the entire company, but he can, and he seems to be on the path to causing significant damage there. And anyone who's got Petrobras in their brokerage account right now probably has bought into the company because their massive dividends. This stock was paying a dividend yield that was almost too good to be true. It was between 25 and 35% per annum. And It's now become apparent over the last couple of days that the dividend policy will be changed significantly. That takes away a key attraction of that particular stock. And then there will also be some state meddling in the investment policy and the CapEx decisions of Petrobras. And that's not going to be to the advantage of the company. So sadly, that investment case, which should have been spectacular because of the long-term need of the world to get oil from, you know, somewhere, and Brazil would have been an ideal supplier. Sadly, that investment case has taken a huge hit. And at the same time, it's very similar to what's happening in the rest of the world. I mean, we Europeans and Americans are always quite arrogant to point at these emerging markets where, you know, their stupid politicians are doing stuff like nationalized companies. And I mean, you know, we have in various countries now these windfall taxes, as they call them, which is really just a partial nationalization through the back door. And, you know, we are not all that much better than they are. And energy companies, and in particular fossil fuel companies, following these years of ongoing campaigns against them, they have the same issue everywhere. It's just politicians being against them and trying to, you know, get money from them, which is money from the shareholders.
Your thoughts, Ira? Yeah, that's very
interesting. Well, the Lula end in Brazil, you know, I'm not so sure, because he did a lot to, yeah, he is a Laborite lefty, but he was cautious to allow a lot of capital to move into Brazil, which I thought was and Brazil did pretty well under him after some terrible years. You know, they went through the current, but he also had the benefit of a currency depreciation well before he came into office, which really helped. And it made for investment, because especially once you started calming inflation, money found its way there. And there's, you know, the Chinese threw a lot of money at it because they need food. They need food.
I just had some work people come into my house. Give me 1 second. Sorry. Sure.
We can edit this piece out. No problem.
My markets are really, sorry, I'm a little, I have to pay attention here. Wow.
Sorry, I'm getting a boiler fixed and they just turned up when
it's not convenient. Yeah.
I hope it heats on things besides natural gas. It's expensive. So.
Okay. And we can edit this piece out, by the way, so no problem. Final question, Sven, is on risk management, how you will go about doing assessment of risk, like whether it's geopolitical, market, credit, operational, you know, especially in developing world markets, and in particular, the risk posed by resource nationalism, you know, government nationalization of industries, because, you know, could that affect the ability to invest in, you know, Crisud, for example? Your thoughts?
Absolutely. It is a huge factor, but is one that's also completely changing right now. So, I mean, as we just spoke about, we used to think of emerging markets as these really risky places where the government comes in and takes your money. And then here we are suddenly having Western governments speak of these enormous windfall taxes on fossil fuel companies, which is really just the same thing. I think my biggest worry going forward in the next couple of years is capital controls. Basically iron curtains going down and you're not able to send your money to particular places or repatriate it again. And I think there's a strong case for diversifying around the globe and having money invested in different parts of the world, because you may be cut off from bank accounts and brokerage accounts in other parts of the world. And as a United States citizen, you are in a lucky position in the sense that private property in your country is extremely well protected and you're probably not going to have that issue. Mind you, I mean, the United States also doesn't have a flawless track record in that regard. But I think for investors in other parts of the world, diversifying around the world is more important than ever before.
Yes, absolutely. And your thoughts, Ira?
I agree. There's all this talk about deglobalization, for whatever that means. So what will lead us that way? Can't tell you, but you're going to run into it. There's so many ways to play with it. Look at Macron is in Washington today fighting with the White House over that Inflation Reduction Act, by the way, which was a way to subsidize the U.S. Green Initiative at the expense of a lot of allies and friends, because the French are very, very upset. Not that that means anything. French are always upset about something, but it's something to take note of. And they're talking about creating the same type of stimulus. So now, are we falling afoul of the WTO, which we accuse everybody else of violating? And how many times does the U.S. get dragged before the WTO? It's a long, drawn out process. But I think Sven's points are right, that we are in a process. Globalization ran wild. When I say globalization, I mean the ability to arbitrage wages all over the world, where money could flow and flow freely, which was a new thing. You know, yes, we can go back to the early 1900s all the way through probably 1928, 1929. But since the Deng Xiaoping in China and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the growth of the Asian tigers, money flowed freely. We had less capital controls in the world than we had in many, many years, since the fall really of Bretton Woods, so 1971. So money really flowed. Now there's some restraints put on it. How far will those restraints go? We don't know. We don't know. We don't know how everybody responds to everybody else's initiative. You know, we have to watch Europe here closely, because they are really angry with the U.S. And is the U.S. going to use NAFTA to shut out everybody else? So we're going to have all types of regionalism. So we'll have the EU bloc, we'll have NAFTA, we'll have Asian, which, you know, so as long as we're, you know, and this is something very, very, that I'm watching closely, and we're seeing, is the weakness in the yen more due to Japan repositioning itself? Because Japan, like the United States, was hollowed out because Japan had too strong a currency for too long. But the weakening yen, which from a purely fundamental standpoint, listen, I know the flawed elements in the BOJ policy, but the weakness in the yen against the euro, against everything over the last year, now we're starting to correct a little bit. Was that done to allow, and believe me, these are policies, to allow Japan to reshore some of its hollowed out manufacturing? And especially, is the world looking for Japan to pick up some of that chip business out of China and start building them, and especially with a weak yen, which gives Japan a huge competitive advantage? So there's things going on here. I think Sven is 100 things that I'm watching. How long will this take to play out? Longer than most people want to believe, especially in the world of algorithms driving a lot of investment decisions that are based totally on price and devoid of all fundamental analysis, as far as I'm concerned, which provide us opportunities as value investors. I love them. I'm not complaining about them. Go ahead, go do your work. Go create value exchanges for myself and others. I look forward to it. Be devoid of fundamentals and be price sensitive only. And believe me, others will find opportunities.
Great. And your final thoughts, Sven, and also how can our listeners, followers learn more about your subscription service, of which we are a subscriber, by the way? It's a great service. So how can they get in touch with you or subscribe to the service?
Right. So I think final words are value investing is the way forward. That's what it really boils down to the next couple of years of, you know, we're going to have some turmoil in markets, but value investing is going to come out ahead, and there will be lots of opportunities in that area. Anyone who wants to get to know my service and my research and my writing, I have a weekly column that is for free If you go to undervalued-shares.com, you'll find my so-called weekly dispatches. They are available on the web. I think I've written 250 of them by now over the last almost 5 years. And my monthly research reports, they're only $49 a year. I'm probably the cheapest offer of this kind on the internet by a factor of 10 or 20. But you know, check out my free writing and then take it from there. It's very easy.
Awesome. And Ira, how can I?
Do you manage a portfolio for investors, Sven, or just?
I'm currently in the process of launching a fund together with a portfolio manager. It's not just going to be me.
Okay. I'm a global macro person. I'm so glad to make, and again, you know, I don't do bottom up analysis. I do when I need to, but that's not the way I perceive the world. I'm a top down person because that's my training. And if I make really good top down analysis, like I'll give you, and I was on with Richard, so I can, and we, you know, back in May and June, we did a few on what was going on, that the grains during the middle of the COVID, that certain things, commodities were holding up very well. They initially took a big hit in March of 2020, but they fought their way back. And the one thing that caught my eye is that the Chinese yuan was appreciating against everything, which was a fly in the ointment to the traditional thought, which is, well, if China is going to protect its markets, it's going to weaken the yuan. But the opposite was taking place. I said, the Chinese are using a stronger currency to buy all these commodities that have been pushed down in price in an effort to stockpile everything that they need. And you know what? It led us to certain investments. It led us to Bunge. It led us to Archer Daniel. It led us to Freeport Mac, you know, Glencore. So we did really well. And this has been, and it was based on that top down. And it was following one of my favorite economists is Michael Pettis. In fact, we wound up doing a podcast with Pettis out of this. And I have great respect for Michael Pettis. You know, I don't always agree with him, but he makes you think just like you make everybody think. Good people make you think. I don't have to agree with you, but that's kind of interesting. So Pettis's view was right too, because if China is building its middle class, you need a strong currency, not a weak currency, because especially when you're importing energy, food, everything that you need, a stronger currency helps you. So it led us to some really good investments. So I applaud you. And I have not been a reader, but I am going there because I can see how simpatico, and you provide another view for me, which is a bottom up. So I will go, wow, that's, you know, that fits. I'm totally in simpatico with that. Or I'll say, well, you know, I don't see that, but that's not a bad thing either. So yeah. I'm always searching. So thank you.
Great. Been a pleasure with you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Sven.
Likewise. Really. Great, insightful discussion. Thank you, Sven and Ira. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.